obtained from innumerable experiments. The slowing down of time according to altitude and speed, the non-existence of the present, the relation between time and the gravitational field, the fact that the relations between different times are dynamic, that elementary equations do not recognize the direction of time, the relation between entropy and blurring. All this has been well ascertained. That the gravitational field has quantum properties is a shared conviction, albeit one currently supported only by theoretical arguments rather than by experimental evidence. The absence of the time variable from the fundamental equations, as discussed in Part 2, is plausible, but on the form of these equations, debate still rages. The origin of time pertaining to quantum non-commutativity, of thermal time, and the fact that the increase in entropy which we observe depends on our interaction with the universe are ideas that I find fascinating, but are far from being confirmed or widely accepted. What is entirely credible in any case is the general fact that the temporal structure of the world is different from the naive image that we have of it. This naive image is suitable for our daily life, but it's not suitable for understanding the world in its minute folds or in its vastness. In all likelihood, it is not even sufficient for understanding our own nature, because the mystery of time intersects with the mystery of our personal identity, with the mystery of consciousness. The mystery of time has always troubled us, stirring deep emotions, so deep as to have nourished philosophies and religions. I believe, as Heinz Reichenbach suggests in one of the most lucid books on the nature of time, The Direction of Time, that it was in order to escape from the anxiety time causes us that Parmenides wanted to deny its existence, that Plato imagined a world of ideas that exist outside of it, and that Hegel speaks of the moment in which the spirit transcends temporality and knows itself in its plenitude. It is in order to escape this anxiety that we have imagined the existence of eternity, a strange world outside of time that we would like to be inhabited by gods, by a god, or by immortal souls. Footnote. There is something extremely interesting about the fact that this observation by Reichenbach in a fundamental text for the treatment of time by analytical philosophy sounds so close to ideas from which Heidegger's reflection stems. The subsequent divergence is enormous. Reichenbach searches in physics for that which we know about time in the world of which we are part, while Heidegger concerns himself with what time is in the existential experience of human beings. The two resultant images of time are completely different from each other. Are they necessarily incompatible? Why should they be? They explore two different problems. On the one hand, the effective temporal structures of the world that reveal themselves to be progressively more threadbare as we widen our gaze. On the other, the foundational aspect that the structure of time has for us, for our concrete sense of being in the world. End of footnote. Our deeply emotional attitude towards time has contributed more to the construction of cathedrals of philosophy than has logic or reason. The opposite emotional attitude, the veneration of time, by a Heraclitus or a Bergson, has given rise to just as many philosophies without getting us any nearer to understanding what time is. Physics helps us to penetrate layers of the mystery. Shows us how the temporal structure of the world is different from our perception of it. It gives us the hope of being able to study the nature of time free from the fog caused by our emotions. But in our search for time, advancing increasingly away from ourselves, we have ended up by discovering something about ourselves. Perhaps. Just as Copernicus, by studying the movements of the heavens, ended up by understanding how the earth moved beneath his feet. Perhaps, ultimately, the emotional dimension of time is not the film of mist that prevents us from apprehending the nature of time objectively. Perhaps the emotion of time is precisely what time is for us. I don't think there is much more than this to be understood. We may ask further questions, but we should be careful with questions that it is not possible to formulate properly. When we have found all the aspects of time that can be spoken of, then we have found time. We may gesture clumsily towards an immediate sense of time beyond what we can articulate. Fine, but why does it pass? But I believe that at this point we are merely confusing matters, attempting illegitimately to transform approximate words into things. When we cannot formulate a problem with precision, it is often not because the problem is profound. It is because the problem is false. Will we be able to understand things better in the future? I think so. Our understanding of nature has increased vertiginously over the course of centuries, and we are continuing to learn. We are glimpsing something about the mystery of time. We can see the world without time. We can perceive with the mind's eye the profound structure of the world, where time, as we know it, no longer exists, like the fool on the hill who sees the earth turn when he sees the setting sun. And we begin to see that we are time. We are this space, this plane opened by the traces of memory inside the connections between our neurons. We are memory. We are nostalgia. We are longing for a future that will not come. The space that is opened up in this way by memory and by anticipation is time, a source of anguish sometimes, but in the end a tremendous gift. A precious miracle that the infinite play of combinations has unlocked for us, allowing us to exist. We may smile now. We can go back to serenely immersing ourselves in time, in our finite time, to savoring the clear intensity of every fleeting and cherished moment of the brief circle of our existence. The Sister of Sleep. The brief arc of our days, O Cestius, prevents us from launching prolonged hopes. Book 1, Ode 4. In the third part of the great Indian epic, the Mahabharata, a certain powerful spirit named Yaksha asks the oldest and wisest of the Pandava, Yudhishthira, what is the greatest of all mysteries? The answer given resounds across millennia. Every day, countless people die, and yet those who remain live as if they were immortals. I would not wish to live as if I were immortal. I do not fear death. I fear suffering, and I fear old age, though less so now that I am witnessing the tranquil and pleasant old age of my father. I am afraid of frailty and of the absence of love. But death does not alarm me. It did not scare me when I was young, and I thought at the time that this was because it was such a remote prospect. But now, at 60, the fear has yet to arrive. I love life. But life is also struggle, suffering, pain. I think of death as akin to a well-earned rest. The Sister of Sleep, Bach calls it, in his marvelous cantata BWV 56. A kindly sister who will come quickly to close my eyes and caress my head. Job died when he was full of days. It's a wonderful expression. I too would like to arrive at the point of feeling full of days, and to close with a smile the brief circle that is our life. I can still take pleasure in it, yes, still enjoy the moon reflected on the sea, the kisses of the woman I love, her presence that gives meaning to everything, still savor those Sunday afternoons at home in winter, lying on the sofa, filling pages with symbols and formulae, dreaming of capturing a small secret from among the thousands that still surround us. I like to look forward to still tasting from this golden chalice, to life that is teeming, both tender and hostile, clear and inscrutable, unexpected. But I've already drunk deep of the bittersweet contents of this chalice, and if an angel were to come for me right now saying, Carlo, it's time, I would not ask to be left even long enough to finish this sentence. I would just smile up at him and follow. Our fear of death seems to me to be an error of evolution. Many animals react instinctively with terror and flight at the approach of a predator. It is a healthy reaction, one which allows them to escape from danger. But it's a terror that lasts an instant, not something that remains with them constantly. Natural selection has produced these big apes with hypertrophic frontal lobes with an exaggerated ability to predict the future. It's a prerogative that's certainly useful, but one that has placed before us a vision of our inevitable death. And this triggers the instinct of terror and flight. Basically, I believe that the fear of death is the result of an accidental and clumsy interference between two distinct evolutionary pressures. The product of bad automatic connections in our brain rather than something that has any use or meaning. Everything has a limited duration. Even the human race itself. The earth has lost its youthfulness. It is past like a happy dream. Now every day brings us closer to destruction, to desert. As Vyasa has it in the Mahabharata, fearing the transition, being afraid of death, is like being afraid of reality itself, like being afraid of the sun. Whatever for? This is the rational version, but our lives are not motivated by rational arguments. Reason helps us to clarify ideas, to discover errors, but that same reason also shows us that the motives by which we act are inscribed in our intimate structure as mammals, as hunters, as social beings. Reason illuminates these connections, it does not generate them. We are not, in the first place, reasoning beings. We may perhaps become so more or less in the second. In the first instance, we are driven by a thirst for life, by hunger, by the need to love, by the instinct to find our place in human society. The second instance does not even exist without the first. Reason arbitrates between instincts, but uses the very same instincts as primary criteria in its arbitration. It gives names to things and to this thirst. It allows us to overcome obstacles, to see things that are hidden. It allows us to recognize the innumerable inefficient strategies, mistaken beliefs, and prejudices that we have. It is developed to help us understand that the tracks we follow, thinking that they will lead to the antelopes we are hunting, are in fact false trails. But what drives us is not reflecting on life. It is life itself. So what really drives us? It is difficult to say. Perhaps we don't know entirely. We recognize motivations in ourselves. We give names to these motivations, and we have many of them. We believe that we share some of them with other animals, others only with humankind, and others still with smaller groups to which we see ourselves as belonging. Hunger and thirst, curiosity, the need for companionship, the desire to love, being in love, the pursuit of happiness, the need to fight for a position in the world, the desire to be appreciated, recognized, and loved, loyalty, honor, the love of God, the thirst for justice and liberty, the desire for knowledge. Where does all this come from? From the way that we are made, from what we happen to be. We are the products of a long selection process of chemical, biological, and cultural structures that at different levels have interacted for a long time in order to shape the funny process that we are, about which we understand very little. By reflecting on ourselves, by looking at ourselves in the mirror, we are more complex than our mental faculties are capable of grasping. The hypertrophy of our frontal lobes is considerable and has taken us to the moon, allowed us to discover black holes, and to recognize that we are the cousins of ladybirds. But it is still not enough to allow us to explain ourselves clearly to ourselves. We're not even clear about what it means to understand. We see the world, and we describe it. We give it an order. We know little of the actual relation between what we see of the world and the world itself. We know that we are myopic. We barely see a tiny window of the vast electromagnetic spectrum emitted by things. We do not see the atomic structure of matter, nor the curvature of space. We see a coherent world that we extrapolate from our interaction with the universe, organized in simplistic terms that our devastatingly stupid brain is capable of handling. We think of the world in terms of stones, mountains, clouds, and people, and this is the world for us. About the world independent of us, we know a good deal, without knowing how much this good deal is. Our thinking is prey to its own weakness, but even more so, to its own grammar. It takes only a few centuries for the world to change, from devils, angels, and witches, to atoms and electromagnetic waves. It takes only a few grams of mushrooms for the whole of reality to dissolve before our eyes, before reorganizing itself into a surprisingly different form. It only takes the experience of spending time with a friend who has suffered a serious schizophrenic episode a few weeks with her struggling to communicate to realize that delirium is a vast piece of theatrical equipment with the capacity to stage the world, and that it is difficult to find arguments to distinguish it from those great collective deliriums of ours that are the foundations of our social and spiritual life and of our understanding of the world. Aside, perhaps, from solitude and the fragility of those who detach themselves from the commonplace order of things, the vision of reality and the collective delirium that we have organized has evolved and has turned out to have worked reasonably well in getting us to this point. The instruments that we have found for dealing with it and attending to it have been many, and reason has revealed itself to be among the best of these. It is precious. But it is only an instrument, a pincer. We use it to handle a substance that is made of fire and ice, something that we experience as living and burning emotions. These are the substances of which we are made. They propel us, and they drag us back, and we cloak them with fine words. They compel us to act, and something of them always escapes from the order of our discourses, since we know that in the end, every attempt to impose order leaves something outside the frame. And it seems to me that life, this brief life, is nothing other than this, the incessant cry of these emotions that drive us, that we sometimes attempt to channel in the name of a god, a political faith, in a ritual that reassures us that fundamentally everything is in order, in a great and boundless love. And the cry is beautiful. Sometimes it is a cry of pain. Sometimes it is a song. And song, as Augustine observed, is the awareness of time. It is time. It is the hymn of the Vedas that is itself the flowering of time. In the Benedictus of Beethoven's Missa Solemnis, the song of the violin is pure beauty, pure desperation, pure joy. We are suspended, holding our breath, feeling mysteriously that this must be the source of meaning, that this is the source of time. Then the song fades and ceases. The silver thread is broken. The gold lantern is shattered. The amphora at the fountain breaks. The bucket falls into the well. The earth returns to dust. And it is fine like this. We can close our eyes, rest. This all seems fair and beautiful to me. This is time. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Order of Time by Carlo Rovelli, translated by Erica Segre and Simon Carnell. This program was produced and directed by Roy McMillan. Text copyright 2017 by Adelphi Edizioni, S.P.A., Milano. Translation copyright 2018 by Simon Carnell and Erica Segre. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Books Limited. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.